Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, we are in Cleveland, Ohio at the headquarters of the Telos Alliance. I'm here with my colleagues, Peter Passian, Marianne Seidler is here, and Ludwig Kugler is here. I think I said that right. We're going to have some great stories from Germany about broadcasting and about technology around the world. It's all coming up next on TWRT.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By Angry Audio. Audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. And by the Calrec Type R console system. Type R is a brand new, modular, expandable IP-based radio system from Calrec Audio.
Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. Delighted to be here. I'm in Cleveland, Ohio today, and instead of being in the Nashville Telos Alliance studio, I'm in the Cleveland Telos Alliance studio, or the Telos Alliance studio. We took over an office here, and we said, get out, we're going to do a show. So here we are. As I said, I'm Kirk Harnack. I do work for the Telos Alliance. I'm part owner of some radio stations as well. And I'm also the host of this show. And we're delighted to have you tuning in and watching with us. So who's with me? Well, I've got two colleagues here. One of this guy I have known forever. In fact,
that's true.
Did I hire you?
Yes.
Offered you a job.
But before that, we worked together too.
That's right.
When I was a dealer. Yes.
So, that's right.
Yeah, right.
This is Peter Passian. Am I saying that right?
Yes.
Peter right. Passian. Yeah. And Peter, you are from where?
I'm from Germany and the south part of Germany, Bavaria, close to Munich. That's where I'm based. And
I took a train to your city from Munich.
Yes.
At Regensburg.
Regensburg.
And you showed me some old buildings or parts of buildings. Yes. How old are these?
Well, the first building in Regensburg where we still have a portal there is from a Roman castle. Mm-hmm. And this was built 179 past Christi.
So AD 179.
No.
No?
179.
179.
179. 179
okay.
past Christi.
Before?
Past.
Past.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's very, very old.
Yeah, it's very old. Yes. Okay. All right. We also have with us, also from Germany, is my new friend, Ludwig Kugler. Yes, hi, Ludwig.
Right. Hi, Kirk.
Did I say it right?
Yes, you did say it right.
Whereabouts do you live in Germany?
I live directly in Munich.
Oh, in Munich. Okay.
Yes, directly in Munich.
Okay. Do you drive a BMW because they're made there?
No.
No?
I'm not driving a BMW. I'm driving Japanese cars.
What?
Yes.
Is that allowed in Germany?
Yes, it is.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'm driving an old BMW.
Okay. Yeah. Good for you.
It is made in the U.S. from Chinese parts, I think.
Yeah, mostly.
So we're here to talk about broadcasting in Germany and engineering. Both of these gentlemen are engineers. Peter, you built a lot of studios,
yes,
didn't you?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I started in the mid of 80s, and from that on, I built a lot of radio studios until 2010. Mm-hmm. And then I changed the side from being a dealer to be a sales director at the manufacturer at Telos.
So in the U.S., I think we might have referred to as a contract engineer or a systems integrator.
Yes, system integrator.
Okay.
Right thing, yes.
And so, but you also did the buy and sell portion. You tried to be a dealer for your favorite products.
Yes, that's true. Yes.
And then you would try to include those in your builds.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tell me about building studios in Germany, even from back in the mid 80s. I was building with cart machines and some turntables. Maybe a Harris Metalist console. Well, how was it like in Germany when you were?
Well, we adapted a lot of stuff in the 80s from the US because before that we only had the national radio, and this was done the very complicated way. You had the control room with the audio engineer, and then you had the talent in the studio.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And
the hand signals.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. And
now, when you say you had national radio, does that mean you didn't have commercial stations?
No. That started mid of the 80s.
Middle of
the 80s. Before that, it was not allowed.
So did the national radio, though, have a lot of studios in smaller towns, or how did this work?
Well, they have the studios in the capital cities, and they had very small studios to distribute to the capital studio.
And then how about transmitters? How was that handled?
The transmitters are handled, and this is going back to the World War II, that this has to be covered by the government, and only the government was allowed to run transmitters.
Mm-hmm.
this changed now, but this was on for a very long time. And so the because the national broadcasters are government-owned or government-controlled, they have their own transmitters. And for the private stations, which started in 1980-something, they had to use either transmitters of the national stations or of, at that time, the government-owned post later on, telecom.
Okay, okay. So the government passed that responsibility to the telecom company.
Right, right.
Gotcha. And so in now in Germany, do commercial broadcasters own their own transmitters, or is it still handled by telecom?
Theoretically, it's possible.
Okay.
But, you know, it's about topology, because you have to have the transmitter at the right point, and all those places are taken. And so the best thing you can do is you just rent the transmitter.
So you're saying the good tower sites are all taken?
Yes, right.
Yeah, and you really can't put up new towers in other places.
Yeah.
Is this because residents, people don't want to have a tower in their backyard?
No, because, yes, probably also, but it's very hard to, you know, coordinate and get the permission for it. And so it's too cumbersome. It's easier to still rent.
Now, I'm not leaving Ludwig out on purpose, but I'm going, your experience is much more recent. So you started engineering in, what, early 2000?
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask you in a few minutes about more modern technologies. But when you were starting, I think you and I were installing the same kind of gear. We were using balanced analog audio.
Yes.
We were using cart machines.
Right.
Turntables.
Turntables, reel-to-reels.
Reel-to-reels, yeah. What did you what kind of audio consoles were typically popular in the 80s and early 90s in Germany?
In Germany, we used the U.S. brands, PR&D.
Oh, yeah.
And the other one was Auditronics.
Oh, those were built in Memphis, Tennessee.
I know.
Well, how about that? Yeah. Wow.
And cartridge machines also from the U.S., Fidelipack, and what was the other one?
ITC.
ITC, right, exactly. And reels to reels, well, that were Studer Revox.
Telefunken.
Oh, wow, okay. Now, you know, Studer had a parts and repair location in Nashville, Tennessee, where I live. And who's the gentleman who was the head of Studer for a long time? Short guy, pretty older now. I saw him at an IBC show, and he said, "You're from Nashville. I used to come to Nashville all the time. I get a taxi from the airport up to Studer."
I can't remember.
Wow. So what about audio processing? How was that working for you?
Because audio processing was not common in Germany before the commercial radio started.
What you mean, the national broadcasters operated with no processing?
With no processing, just with limiters.
Limiters, okay. Yes. Yeah. All right.
So we had transient limiters running for the national radio. So that was the well-known and very good working EMT limiters used everywhere. But there was no, you know, sound processing, no color of sound. It was just, you know, linear. And the private station started to change this. And we, again, adapted to the U.S. and took the U.S. brands. We had Orban. We had Texar Audio Prisms.
Oh, yeah. Did you have CRL? Was that?
Yes, also, yeah. So all those brands were, you know, what was used in Germany too.
You know, a few episodes back, we spoke with Jim Hoag, who was one of the kind of co-inventors of the Texar Audio Prism. Him and Glenn Clark.
Yeah,
that was pretty. And oh gosh, 10 years ago, we had Bob Orban on the show. Of course, now we talk to Frank Fodia a bit more.
Yes.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah. What about how did you link studios and transmitters back at this time in the 80s and 90s?
That was also done by the telecom. So they gave us their codecs. And at that time, it was already... When I started, it was analog.
So it was dry lines, equalized phone lines?
Yes.
Okay. Right. So you put +4, +8 audio in. It would have equalizer maybe in the middle or at the end.
Right. And then get it out. And then... Okay. In the 90s, they started to replace that with codecs, and that was MPEG Layer 2, 256 kilobit per second.
and we had to rent those codecs.
And the processor would go at the transmitter side?
No, at the studio side.
What? Now, wait, you've told me this before, and this seems nuts.
It's
because
nuts.
You're taking a process signal,
mm-hmm.
limited and clipped for FM?
Yes.
Well, left and right separate, not multiplex.
Yeah, no multiplex, left and right.
Left and right, but processed, so could be hard limited to some degree.
Yes.
And this goes into a codec, which we know has overshoots.
Yep.
And this goes to the transmitter site.
At that time, we didn't know about the overshoots. We were wondering why, you know, the signal was not correct. And in the beginning of the codecs, the German telecom thought that, okay, you have to give us 0 dB. And that didn't leave any headroom.
Oh.
Which made it even worse. You know, the overshoots of the codecs plus the clipping of the audio.
Yeah, yeah.
It sounded terrible.
By the way, so where did the stereo generation take place for the FM stations?
In the transmitter. So they used the stereo generator off the transmitters.
Well, typically, what brand of a transmitter? So you have left and right going into the transmitter.
Rode and Schwarz, Telefunken, that was all the German brands, yes.
Okay. So no processing transmitter side, but processed left-right audio with some overshoots goes in. You get stereo from the exciter.
Yes.
And then you're on the air with FM. What's a typical power level in Germany for FM?
Depends on, but the commercial stations had low power because it was just local radio.
Okay.
Talking about between 500 watts and 1500.
Okay. So
that was common.
Were these, back then, were any of these solid state transmitters or were they still a tube transmitter?
Solid state.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. What about the national radio with bigger transmitters?
That went up to 100 kilowatts, depending where, you know. So especially at the border, they had the high power. So the Austrian had a 100K transmitter, and the Bavarians had.
Make sure all you Austrians hear our signal. Yeah,
that's right.
Wow. Oh, my goodness. Now, I'll come back in a bit and ask you about this MPX limiting that you have there. That's going to be fairly interesting. Now, I will ask you, I engineered at smaller stations, and we missed the entire AES3 or AES-EBU digital conversion. We didn't see any big advantages of that for us, so we kept analog until AOIP came along.
Yeah.
Did you guys do a lot of AES digital?
Yes, so as soon as that was widely available, you know, we got rid of analog, and we just used AES-EBU, AES3.
Okay. So the only analog you had then would have been a microphone and speaker feed. Yeah?
And speaker feed and headphone feed, yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Wow. Oh, yeah. So how did you do, now in a lot of the rest of the world, you call it OB for outside broadcast. Mm-hmm. We call them often remotes. How did you get a signal from a remote site, a truck or something, back to the studio?
So in the early days, it was the balanced, equalized telephone line.
Yeah, you'd order a phone line.
Yes, okay. You'd order a phone line, which was very cumbersome. And most of the time, it didn't work properly.
Okay.
Then a couple of stations applied for getting a FM frequency in the lower frequency. So that was about 70
megahertz?
70 megahertz.
Okay.
Below the FM band send signal back to the station.
Yeah.
And then when ISDN came available, that was a big benefit because then we could use the ISDN codecs, and then it was easy because you just had to, you know, order a ISDN line and then you use that.
So obviously ISDN was one of the big products from our employer, Telos.
Right.
Do you know what brand of codecs you were using with ISDN back then?
Back then, there was a very famous one in Germany. It was called the Music Taxi.
The Music Taxi. Oh my gosh! Yes. What a great name!
Yeah.
Okay.
And then we, of course, also used the U.S. brands. We used Telos. We used CCS.
Yes, that's right.
That was very common. Yeah.
Wow. And this was ISDN terribly expensive? Was it pretty reasonable? You could have it installed pretty quickly, or what?
It wasn't cheap, but it was reasonable at that time, and it was flexible because you could have it everywhere, right? And the most remote location, so if you do a remote from a shopping center, for instance, they had ISDN there, so it was really easy to just plug it in and use that.
Wow. Hey, you are watching or listening to This Week in Radio Tech. It's our 479th episode. I'm Kirk Harnack. We're live in studio at, well, in a makeshift studio. We moved somebody out of their office and took over here at the Telos Alliance in Cleveland, Ohio. We're here for some meetings this week, and that's why my colleague Peter Passion is here. And I'm going to turn my attention now over to Ludwig Kugler. Ludwig, thanks for joining us. And have I met you at NAB briefly?
Yes, only for short view.
Yeah, okay. All right. So you act as our dealer distributor in Germany.
Yeah, that's right.
And you're in Munich.
Yes.
So talk to us about, you're familiar with ISDN.
Yes, I am.
But is this pretty much going away in Germany?
The problem is that it's not supported anymore.
Yeah.
So if you have ISDN now, so-called ISDN, it's SIP in the back, and in the front, it's something like ESDN.
Okay. Now I got to hear you talk a couple of days ago about audio over IP. And so you're a young engineer. You're in business for yourself, doing engineering, installing studios like Peter was back 100 years ago. I mean, 30 years ago. So, but audio over IP is very much a part of your knowledge base.
Yeah, that's right.
So tell me your thoughts about this. You know, when I first read Steve Church's paper about putting audio on a computer network, this must have been in 2003, maybe 2004. I read it five times before I went, I think maybe this could work. Because, before then, it was always you connect an output to an input. Whether it was analog or whether it was AES, EBU, you have an output and you have an input and you run a wire between these two things. Yeah. So how was your own adoption? How did you become accustomed to audio over IP on a computer network?
That's a good question. It was first when I was not self-employed. Mm-hmm. I worked also with another dealer before who was dealer in Germany for Axia. And that was where I had the first contact with it. And I thought, wow, that's an interesting thing. And it seems to work. And it works since that time. It's now 7 or 8 years ago.
So the standard of Livewire has been around for a long time, but there's a standard that's really popular in Europe, and that's called Ravenna.
Yeah.
And it's very similar in a lot of ways to what – in fact, it's almost directly compatible. Yeah. And then we have now AES-67. We have Dante, which began as something that was not at all compatible, but everyone is kind of morphing a bit into, say, to an AES-67 compatibility. What is your view on these different technologies and how they either work together, don't work together? What's your advice when you're selling a system as to what standard should people be going with?
To be honest, they should be going with Livewire, not because I'm the dealer, but I've seen all of the standards at the moment. And for me, Dante has a little bit the problem. It's quite for a very small environment. So it works there. It's easy to use for them. But if you want to transport something like GPIOs over network or something like that, then Livewire for me is the only choice that's out there at the moment. And it works for several years. And if we have a look to Ravenna, we have the big problem that they are used to have very cost-intensive structure of the P2P clocking and so on, and P2P-aware switches, and that's all the stuff we do not need when we use Livewire.
We just saw a seminar about that today from Greg Shea. Greg has been a guest on our show, and this is a little bit interesting, this idea of clocking. You know, we've one of our previous guests on the show, in fact, it was Greg Oganowski, who was part of Orban, but Greg Oganowski says, a man with two watches never knows what time it is.
Yeah.
And this is very true. So in a digital network, whether it's AES-EBU or whether it's a bit of a fuzzy network like an IP network, we have to distribute clock to everywhere. And I didn't know this until today that the equipment that the company we work for, Telos, our Livewire gear has always had this ability to filter some fuzziness out and derive a very accurate clock.
Yeah.
And apparently most other companies depend on less fuzziness, and so maybe they need a more expensive network in order to work. And this, I didn't know this until today.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing is in Germany, especially if you look to the large public broadcasters there, they are not really in use of audio over IP as you want to have it, because they really don't know how to use the quality of service classes. And what they mostly do is they put in the quality of service class 7, they put their business apps like SAP or something like that. And I say, well, there has to be the PTP because that's the real-time application and you need it there. And they say, well, but our boss needs to have accurate information without 10 milliseconds. And I say, well, it doesn't matter whether he gets it in 10 milliseconds or 2 seconds. But that's the truth at the moment in Germany,
That's interesting. Now, and of course, in most of my installations, the audio network, AOIP network, was a physically separate network from the business network. We try to keep those separate, and maybe for reasons like this. Tell me a little bit about the studios that people are asking for now. What are they smaller than they used to be? Bigger? Are they fancy? What? Tell me about what's a studio look like that you would build these days?
That depends on the customer needs. And the problem in Germany still is that they stuck on a lot of metal stuff, and they really want to have consoles and faders and so on. But I want to go normally a step further to say, as far as possible, leave the metal work out and try to move it to something on a computer, something on a touchscreen or something like that, because it makes it much more easier if something breaks down. You only buy a new monitor and then it works and you get the monitor within one day. And if you have to buy a new console, it's much more expensive. And it's, it's... It works for 7 years, 5, 6, 7, 8 years, and then you have to change it.
And it's very hard to spill a cup of coffee into a monitor.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's right. You can spill a cup of coffee. It'll run right off the monitor. Wow. So there's now the talent in Germany.
Yeah.
Are they young guys like you, or are they old guys like me?
Most of the time, young guys like
me. Oh, really?
Me, They're younger than me.
Okay. Well, I've been doing a little bit of research on this, and I have a friend. He's also been on the show, Alex Hartman. And Alex explains that, hey, these new touchscreens and controlling an audio console, we've seen demos of that, right? We saw a great demo yesterday with Greg Shea. These touchscreens, this isn't for the 60-year-old announcer. This is for the younger person whose their whole life is, swipe left, swipe right, up, down. They're accustomed to this. It's in their brain to deal with a touchscreen.
Yeah, that's right. But on the other hand, they want to have a knob where they can press on, and then it starts to fade, and they know, oh, there's a signal now.
Okay, so they like that tactile feedback.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, maybe we should just put a spring under the touchscreen. It'll bounce when they...
Yeah, absolutely.
Normally, there is technology coming that you get feedback from the touchscreen.
Haptic feedback. I heard the military has this already. Yeah. I don't know. It takes a while to trickle down to us.
Well, I had a rental car the other day where the touchscreen had this haptic. So when you touch the right spot, so you can blindly go over the screen. Mm-hmm. And then if you come to the spot where the button is, you get a vibration and then you press it. And
It's like so many things, like a typical iPhone. If this phone is off, this button feels like nothing.
Yeah.
But if you touch it, it feels like you pressed it.
Yes.
Really, it kicked you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And wow. All right. I'm going to have a couple more questions. We got to take a quick break, and actually that break is going to be me talking about one of our sponsors, and that's Broadcast Tools and the Pro Mix 4, which is a pretty interesting little audio console. The Pro Mix 4 from Broadcast Tools is designed it's a mono console. It's a compact, full-featured monaural audio mixing console, perfect for almost any broadcast studio. It has 3 combination mic line inputs and a dedicated 4th input that can be switched between balanced line and the built-in USB audio interface. That USB is so cool. That means you can pull audio from the computer that you're plugged into. And by the way, it doesn't matter if it's a Mac or a PC or even a Linux computer. It's that universal USB. You plug it in and you just get audio. It also has 3/4-inch stereo headphone outputs. They're included with individual controls for volume, mixing, and panning. That allows your custom headphone mixes. It's got other features, including a switch-selectable program limiter, so your sports guy can say something like, my famous line, he shoots, he scores, and he won't distort the thing. XLR program output, monitor output with muting and volume control. Muting is that's important. You buy one of these mixers like we're using today, a little Behringer mixer. It doesn't have muting. It doesn't have anything to light up a studio light. Well, this is built in to the Broadcast Tools Pro Mix 4. It also has a mix minus output, so you can have a telephone hybrid or a codec right there with you if you want to take phone calls, get some callers to call in and talk to the coach or whatever kind of show that you're doing. It's a great choice for remote broadcasting, and it's a great choice for podcasting applications. So I encourage you to go check it out. The Pro Mix 4, this is from Broadcast Tools, and it's available from our sponsor, Broadcasters General Store. Call BGS, go on their website, and get the Pro Mix 4 from BGS, Broadcasters General Store. By the way, I just spent the last 3 days with Dave Kirsten and Carrie Kirsten, two of the owners of Broadcasters General Store. And I mean, what a great outfit they are. I have bought a lot of gear from them. And you call them up and you say, hey, Dave, Carrie, I need a really sharp pencil on this. And they can make you some amazing deals. The other thing I like about BGS, seriously, is they have their whole ordering system and their stock management system and their shipping system. It's really integrated quite well. And normally they can tell you exactly how long your product is going to take to get to you. Hey, I need some headphones. Hey, I need to buy 5 microphones. Hey, I need an FM exciter. Hey, I need a video monitor. Hey, I need a panel of LED lights for our radio studio to light our new video broadcast. BGS has the ability to tell you the lead time, where it is, if it's shipped, if it's not shipped, how soon it's going to get to you. They really work hard. So check them out at bgs.cc, Broadcasters General Store, and I really appreciate them sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. Let's talk just a couple more minutes with Ludwig Kugler.
Yes,
Ludwig Kugler. And we were talking about studios. Tell me about, you know, the kind of work that you do. Is it mostly studio work?
Normally I'm doing more the planning and more the dealer side, because I'm only by myself in my company. And if you have to build a large facility or something like that, then it's not possible for me to do that, but I can plan it, and I can draw the plans and say what should come into the studio. And yeah, it works quite well.
What are some of the technologies that broadcasters are doing nowadays? Are they virtualizing much of anything? Are there a lot of PCs in or servers in racks? Or is it still more traditional?
It depends also, but it's quite still traditional. I believe that the public broadcasters start now a little bit to switch over in some areas to the virtualization, but it's far more behind than it is in the US or possibly in the UK.
Wow. I always think of Germany as being such a leader in technology, but you know, sometimes you want to be sure something works first before you...
Yeah, well, you know, we are engineers, and engineers want to have metalwork and stuff, you know, and that's the problem. We do not have so much software engineers in Germany.
Gotcha. Let's see. What about digital broadcasting? What's going on with, is DAB a thing? DRM? What's going on there?
Yes, DAB is a thing, is pushed by as well the public broadcasters. The private broadcasters, well, for them it's only a side product, and they use it, and well, it's there and we pay for it, and that's all we do. And there's even the FM program going on DAB side out, so there is no special processing and nothing like that. The public broadcasters want to have it, and I believe they want to push it through.
What kind of schooling or did you have to learn about broadcast engineering, or did you learn it by on the job training?
No, I studied sound and vision engineering.
Oh, okay.
And after that, I did an MBA to get all the sales stuff done.
Oh, yeah, perfect.
Yeah, and so the broadcast stuff I started, well, about 7, 8, 9 years ago to go deeper into it.
Yeah. Wow. Well, good luck with your continued planning. Now, when you plan something, do you between you and the broadcaster, you hire a systems integrator that's going to do the big job?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, we have a lot of system integrators in Germany, and they are quite good. And so it's not a problem that they do the work.
Now, you mentioned, or one of you mentioned, that one of the really popular brands in Germany is DHD.
Yes.
I've heard of this. I've seen some of their consoles. They're typically using Dante as their connection mechanism. Yep. What is it? Where is DHD located?
They're also in Germany, in the eastern part of Germany.
Leipzig. Okay, cool. All right. Well, good luck with that, and continue pressing for LiveWire and AES67.
Yeah, I hope so.
It works. It works well. All right. Ludwig, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to swap you out for Marianne here, and I'm going to turn my attention back to Peter. So, Peter, in Germany, what is, thinking about your career, in different technologies, analog and AES-EBU and now AOIP, are there any other big shifts in technology that you've seen, or shifts in maybe the way stations operate? How are they different now than they were in the mid-80s when you were starting this?
Well, I mean, what shifted dramatically is, you know, how the content gets in. So first of all, the music, when I started, mm-hmm. you know, as we talked about, we were playing records.
Records, CDs.
Then later on, CDs. We had content coming from cards and mm-hmm. the reel-to-reels. And this all changed into be one computer platform, as is also used in the US. And I think at that point we were in front of the US, but then mm-hmm. you made up and passed us, I think, in regards of computer technology in the studios. So this was a big change, and was also a big change, and that's a bit of the downside of the commercial radio, because of getting the cost down, news and all that stuff they buy instead of produce by themselves.
Yeah. One thing I've noticed, that the pictures that you provide from studios in Germany, so often these studios, the consoles are not on top of the table, but they're flush mounted right. in the table.
Yeah.
And you, as our dealer in Germany, and then our sales director for the whole Eastern Hemisphere, you have always encouraged Telos to make available these flush mount.
Yeah.
Why is this popular?
Well, I mean, it's popular because a lot of console manufacturers are coming from Germany or Studer from Switzerland, but you know, Europe, and mm-hmm. Most of them had those flush mount frames, so people were used to it. And I wouldn't say that only the German radio stations like that. Also, Middle East, for instance, mm-hmm. they like the flush mount frames because they use the German console manufacturers for their studios. So it comes with the brand. And so people got used to, and I mean, there are a lot of benefits because you can spread them out through the tabletop.
Like the one we saw in Bolzano, Italy.
Exactly, which is kind of a curve.
It looks really nice.
Yeah,
very, very custom job. Hey, I want to bring your colleague in. Marianne, can you come in? You find your headset? I want to introduce everyone to our colleague, Marianne Seidler. Hi, Marianne.
How are you doing?
I'm good. Pull that microphone a little close to your mouth,
all right.
And we'll have a conversation. So now you lived in Germany for a while, yeah?
Yes.
We have a great history together.
Yeah.
You what?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, Marianne is the reason that I'm sitting here.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
She brought me to the company as a dealer. Uh-huh. So that happened 1990-something.
Oh,
yeah. Late 90s.
So that was with your company, PNP, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Now, for those of you watching, Marianne has actually been on the show before years and years ago, but the camera didn't work, and you was only your voice on.
That's right.
And you got to know that Marianne Seidler is not just a pretty face. This young lady knows her technology, and you have visited radio stations and helped people with their processing and audio consoles and telephone systems literally all over the world. Yeah?
That's true. It's called processing, though. There's no way.
Okay.
I knew that was coming.
If you hear me say processing, it's only for it's only to keep her happy. When she's gone, it's back to processing.
So one of the best stories, so
yeah.
I've got a ton, but is how I met Peter and how Peter met Frank.
Okay,
it was hilarious.
That is Frank Foti you're speaking of. Okay.
So when we first set up the office in Germany, I got a call from a guy who said, "I have a Unity 2000." And this was the predecessor to any Omnia product,
mm-hmm.
which was fascinating. I couldn't figure out.
This would have been late 90s.
Yeah.
Or mid-90s.
Mid-90s.
Okay.
And he was having a problem with it. Well, it turned out that the AES was in Munich that year. I said, hey, you're in luck.
The Audio Engineering Society.
Yes. Oh, okay. Sorry.
No, sorry.
So I said, actually, Frank is going to be here. So why don't I bring him by and mm-hmm. we can solve whatever the issue is? So, Peter, I'll...
So, Frank came into the story, Chadlek, directly from the U.S., and was a bit, not amused, you know,
to be drawn to the
race station right away. Okay. And he looked at the unit and said, "Peter, the jumper's inside are set wrong." And I said, "Frank, I read the manual and I did exactly what's written in the manual." And he said, "No, the jumpers are set wrong. Give me a screwdriver. Let's open up the unit." And he looked inside and he said, "What I told you, you know, the jumpers are set wrong." He set the jumpers right, put the lid bag on, put the Unity 2000 back into the rack. And, you know, it was working nicely. And in the meantime, I went to get the manual and said, "Frank, look here in the manual." "Yeah, then the damn manual is wrong."
Okay, of course.
And away we went.
And away you went after that.
Yes, and from that on, you know, he was in a good mood, and we had a really nice conversation about order processing.
Thank you.
And yeah.
I've also been introduced to another colleague in Germany that most of our viewers and listeners would not have heard of, and that's Tony Timmett.
Yes.
And you and Tony are good friends.
Yes, yeah. And Tony and I started the office together. So Tony is he used to work at Fraunhofer.
He's
a very, very smart software engineer. He did a lot of work with Layer 3.
Yes.
Layer 3.
Yeah.
But when we set up the office, you know, we had to do everything. So... I was in charge of everything from obviously sales, but boxing things up, shipping stuff. And Tony, in between being a software engineer, was also the tech guy too. So he was doing any repair calls and things like that. Mm-hmm. So he would be in his office playing just what I considered really god-awful music. And then I'd be in my office playing what I'm sure he considered just horrible music. So, yeah, we had that was excellent. Yeah, from there, when I think about how much larger the company is, because we were probably employees like number 12 and 13 at Telos. Yeah.
So Telos has a lot of history with the country of Germany. A lot of that because Fraunhofer was there, and the story that I'm sure it's been told on the show way in the past about how Fraunhofer invented MP3 for the purpose of it getting adopted into digital audio broadcasting, and it didn't. That committee picked MPEG Layer 2 instead. Yes. So Fraunhofer said, "Oh, well, we'll put this on the shelf," and they put MP3 on the shelf and went about their business. Steve heard about this and thought, "Wait a minute. MP3, 128 kilobits per second. ISDN, 2B channels, 128 kilobits per second. We might have a match here." So Steve came to Germany, met the people at Fraunhofer. May have met Tony at that time. I don't know.
Probably.
And hired him later on from Fraunhofer. So wow.
So
by the way, there is a story. So the first time I met or ran into Steve was at NAB 1996.
Okay.
And there was a panel going on, the future of the internet. Just to remember that time, you know, all you got was CompuServe.
I had
a 14.4K modem.
Yes.
And, you know, pictures in the size of 100K or so kilobyte, you know, it was split into 9 or 12 parts to download them.
Right.
And if you missed one part, you didn't get the whole picture. So the panel was about, you know, the future of the internet. And speakers on the panel was Steve, a guy from Microsoft, and a guy from AT&T.
Mm-hmm.
So the AT&T guy said, the future of the internet, we see that we can have telephony over the internet. And I thought, well, okay, 3.5 kilohertz bandwidth per phone call, that will fit into a modem. So that could be possible. Not a lot of callers, you know, going through that pipe, but, you know, that could work. And then the Microsoft engineer said, yeah, and in the future, you know, downloads for software or updates for the software, you just download. And I thought, okay, Office at that time was 13 or 14
3.5
floppy disks, 3.5-inch floppy disks. Okay, if you leave the modem on for 2 days, that probably also works. And then Steve came up and he said, well, and what I didn't know was at that time he unveiled the MP3, so he knew there's a way to reduce that as of music or media. And he said, well, I see the future of the internet that we'll be able to listen to music over the internet, high quality, and probably also in the future TV.
Yeah.
And I said, you are crazy. That will never work. Look where we are.
Yeah, look where we are now. Yes. Absolutely.
Right.
Oh, that would have been in the early 90s, I suppose.
1996.
Oh, 96.
It was exactly that year when Steve brought up the Zephyr with the ISDN MP3 codec.
Stay tuned, because we're about to have Marianne tell us this amazing story about installing a transmitter, processor, something in India, and you were in a skirt and high heels on top. Won't give it away. We'll keep our powder dry, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by my friends at Angry Audio, and I'm going to hold up a couple cool things here. This is the Angry Audio Guest Gizmo right here. What this is, a headphone amp. Not only a headphone amp, but it's also an on-off and mute button that works with your audio console. It's got the logic to figure that out. And, can this light the light? No, I'm not sure if this can light the light or not. But anyway, the Guest Gizmo. So, yeah, it can light the light. This will light the LED tally light on your Mika mic arm. That has the beautiful little ring on there that lights the tally light. This is so cool. The headphone amp is really good, really strong, lets you hear it. And you see how it's square, but you don't have to drill a square hole in your console. You drill a 2 3/4 inch round hole with a hole saw and drop this baby in. And it just looks great. It looks like you spent all day installing that. And truth is, you spent 5 minutes. It's just terrific. Angry Audio has some other options, though, for headphone amps. I mean, 3 different options. Why? Well, you know, some of them it's kind of by accident, but others because this is what people need. So if you want a different style of headphone amp, here's one. This goes under your audio console, under the table, and you can see how rounded it is. So you're not going to catch your knee or your skirt or your trousers on this thing. And it's powered either by a wall wart power supply or by the power available in the Studio Hub standard. So you can power this with a Studio Hub. You can also daisy chain this. And if you power it with the wall wart, well, you can, this becomes an injection point for power to other units. So this is a great option. It's got both the 1/4 inch and the 1/8 inch connectors for your headphone amp. And then, of course, they have, a lot of folks really still love these. This is the headphone amp from Studio Hub, originally from Radio Systems. Angry Audio has these now, and this is in the Decora format, which means there's all kinds of hardware at the hardware store for mounting or covering these, but you can also get something like this, which lets you mount this under the cabinet, ta-da, like that, and it makes a great solution. It's a lower-cost solution, and it's Studio Hub wiring in and out. One more thing to talk about Studio Hub. Angry Audio has a great supply, and they're making more of the Studio Hub cable adapters. These are the ones that go from RJ45 in Studio Hub format to your XLR connectors, male or female. You can also get them in RCA connectors and 1/4 inch tip ring sleeve. But here's the deal. Listen up, Twert listeners and viewers. If you call your dealer, like Broadcaster General Store or one of the other dealers that handles Studio Hub, tell them you want your free cable. And you may have to actually admit that you heard it on Twert. But they'll give you, for every one of these you buy, they'll give you a free 7-foot shielded patch cable from Studio Hub, and it's certified, ready to go, and it's going to work just great for you. And it's free. Save you a few dollars instead of having to buy them. Just tell them your old buddy Kirk, you know, sent you in, and buy some of those, and they'll take care of you. AngryAudio.com is the website. You can see you get it from your favorite dealer, and be sure you insist from your dealer that you get your free patch cables. That, by the way, that's a Twert exclusive. So please let them know because they're not, broadcast engineers are not hearing that deal anywhere else except right here. AngryAudio.com. Ask for your free patch cable. All right, we're talking here with Peter Passian from Regensburg, Germany, in Bavaria, and also with Marianne Seidler from, you're in Maine, aren't you?
Yes, up in the Northeast. In Portland.
Portland, Maine.
The original Portland.
Oh, really? Well, the other Portland's just named after it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, actually, they were deciding between naming it Portland and Boston, and they named it Portland.
So you have this amazing, you've been around the world, crazy broadcast engineer stories. Tell us this thing about India and going up to a transmitter site.
So I have two really great stories, and one is about Steve Church, and the other is about installing this processor in India. So we were installing it on top of a building. But the building.
What city are we in here?
I think it was Mumbai.
Okay, Mumbai.
So we were installing it on top of a building, but the problem was the building was still under construction. So we get up to the roof, and the roof isn't finished yet. So it's all these wooden planks. And they're all uneven because you had to go from one building, and I think we had to go up like a little ramp to another building. Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't know at the beginning of the day this is what we were going to do. So I was in a dress and probably 3 or 4 inch. I was working on my, you know, look, trying to be fashionable. 3 or 4 inch spiked heels. So I had to try to walk through all of this, and it was really thin paths and spiked high heels. But then we had to go up a staircase, but the staircase was open.
Wait, you mean that steel grating?
Yes, exactly.
That scrapes mud off as you walk?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
And so what? That doesn't work with high heels, does it?
So
that's like a cattle guard.
So there was nothing I could do, and I wasn't going to admit that it was painful. I took my shoes off and walked up the stairs.
Oh, man.
And it was then I put the shoes back on, but then we had to go up some ramp.
Are you carrying the processor at this point?
No, thank goodness. I think somebody else was
hoofing that.
But they wanted to carry me over this ramp, and I thought, you know, no, I give her a lot of reasons. I think this, first of all, I don't want anyone to know how much I weigh. But secondly, no, this is so I somehow shimmied up the ramp, and then we installed the processor. So I would guess the vast majority of people in this industry have never installed a processor in high heels, and it was around 120. Degrees.
Oh.
And I couldn't take my jacket off, so I was just, but I wasn't going to show anyone that I was having a problem. So, yeah.
You got the processor installed.
We did get the processor installed.
Did you adjust it? Did they adjust it?
No, they just wanted to go because we couldn't hear it. So I think we made some minor adjustments, but
got the input and output levels good.
Yeah,
and
yeah, and that was it.
Picked a preset and off you go.
Yeah, yeah.
They were probably very happy with it. It was probably way better than whatever they had before.
It was a new station, and that's when Andy was going with all these private radio stations. So everything about it was new.
Wow. I've been to a transmitter site on a building in India. Don't remember which city it was for sure. And this building also wasn't finished. I don't think it was the same building because this would have been 2006 or 7 or 8. But yeah, it's crazy what they do.
Yeah,
it's just
crazy. It was stunning. Now, do you want to hear my Steve Church story?
Well, I don't know. Do you? I guess so. Yes. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah. It's pretty funny. So this was when Axia first started. And Steve and I were going to do a demonstration for a day in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to, our dealer had got a little room set up at a hotel. So Steve and I, because we were so used to the world of analog audio and just setting things up before AOIP, so we allocated an entire day.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to the place, set up the Axia console, and
this might have been a smart surface back then?
Yeah.
Okay.
And 45 minutes. And we had all this Omni equipment. We had everything set up. And 45 minutes later, we were done.
It was
and we were sitting there looking at each other.
I know
going,
this feeling.
Yeah. It's 10:45 in the morning.
What are we
and Steve, oh, I love Steve. He was like, I guess we have the afternoon off. Right.
Oh.
And we were like, are we sure it's done? This is, and we kept kind of second guessing ourselves whether this was actual, but it was. So we had the afternoon.
You know, this does speak to something, and that is about our expectations for how long does it take to wire something or do something. And I know you've had or been involved with AOIP projects. Of course, me being part owner of some radio stations, I moved 5 radio stations the actual move was about a 2.5 day move, and the wiring was may have been, it took longer to do things like run something through the ceiling than it did to hook things up and type some channel numbers and connect what to what. And we were done before we knew it. I'm not saying, it was all the other stuff that was difficult, the physical labor.
Right. But it's really a plug and play.
It's a what?
It's a plug and play.
Plug and play. Yeah. Absolutely.
It's so easy.
Yeah.
You just get the RG45 checks in and you're done. And when we set up radio stations, so we had the company, which did the power and the lights and everything.
Mm-hmm.
We asked them also to run the Cat 5, Cat 6 cables and, attach them to patch bays in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just plugged into the patch bay and we were up and running.
I've never had the pleasure of having this done for me, but you hired a networking company that installs networking cable. Right.
No, the company which is doing, the power and the light. And,
They did the structured cabling, too.
They did the structured cable, too. We just told them, run 10 cables from here to there and from there to there. And in the studios, instead of, you know, wall outlets, mm-hmm. we gave them patch panels, 19-inch, okay. and they attached the cables to the patch panels, tested all cables, certified them. We got, you know, certification about mm-hmm. All the measures, and they say the same they did in the master control in the rec room. And so no additional work here. We just had really to plug and play.
For broadcast engineers, that is almost, it has been unthinkable that it could be that easy.
Yeah. And plus, because we used at that time also the LiveWire protocol, you know, you didn't have to think about the control protocol and GPIOs separately because it was the same cable.
Yeah, 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 exactly. Same cable. And this is interesting because Ludwig brought this up and heard about it today, is that the other AOIP protocols don't necessarily have GPIO built in and control built in.
So we are the only one. So LiveWire is the only one.
Yeah.
Now I can say we because I'm working for the company. But at that time, I was a dealer. But I, from the beginning, was convinced about that is the way to go. And we are the only ones which have GPIOs control metadata in the same cable as the audio.
Wow. Wow.
And that makes the life so easy for the installs.
Marian, I know that you have been quite a bit to Africa. You've made a lot of friends in Africa and introduced them to audio processing there. What's I got to believe that, and I had a little bit of this pleasure myself, but introducing people who are hungry for some technology and knowledge and introducing them to some really quality gear. What's been some of your success story from there?
So Peter and I had a great story. So yes. mm-hmm. he and I went there together, and we went to a lot of stations in Kenya.
Okay.
Which was fascinating. But then we went to a station in Tanzania, and we weren't sure it was EFM. And we went there, and our dealer had not heard of this network, this station. So we show up outside a building, and the building, you know, it was modern enough, but it was guarded by, honest to God, a Maasai warrior, which was very impressive. just very impressive looking. Okay. So we had a big knife. So we went into the building, and it was, oh my gosh, it was like Alice in Wonderland. This place was spectacular. Hmm. I mean, it was state of the art. Hmm. And what was the coolest part of that is in one of the studios, they were sitting there talking. They had a sports show on at noon, and they were speaking Swahili. We didn't understand what they were saying, but it was obviously talking about basketball, and it was something, 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 LeBron James,
okay.
something, 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 Kobe Bryant. And I was like, oh, yeah, excellent.
Oh, wow.
But they absolutely insisted that they wanted an Omni 11, and they wanted LiveWire. I mean, they were really, and yeah, we spent quite a bit of time talking to them about it, and they wanted a big U.S. sound, and they got it.
Yeah, they got it. Unfortunately, they didn't have the budget for LiveWire, so they're still on their old consoles, but they have an Omni 11 running, and they are so happy with that sound. Yeah.
Thinking about all around the world, where are a couple of hotspots where technology adoption is really cutting edge? Where would you say is?
I would say Down Under.
Yeah. Oh, Australia.
Yeah, yes. Australia and New Zealand is
yeah,
of really...
Course. Of course.
Yeah. They always want to have the top-of-the-notch stuff, and...
I interviewed the former director of engineering for Southern Cross Austereo, Steve
Adler.
Yeah, Steve Adler. And I remember in that interview, and this has been, my goodness, it's probably been 5 years, 5-6 years ago. And Steve said, Kirk, he says, if it doesn't have a blue cable with an RJ45 jack, we're not interested. Right. Everything. Mm-hmm. And now they have this flexibility that's amazing. There's a footy game going on, you know, three towns away, and the station can basically hit a few keys on a keyboard and play that game.
Right.
You know, get those announcers mm-hmm. on their station. They just have this amazing flexibility between the satellite, the terrestrial distribution, and everything being on IP.
Yeah.
Just amazing.
And I think,
what do you think?
France.
Oh, yeah, yeah. France and UK. UK is also, I mean, what BBC is doing with our gear, with audio IP is amazing. And also the other two big radio groups, Power Group and Global Radio Group, are, you know, getting everything out of it.
So I've been to Capital FM in London, mm-hmm. and that studio with the changing lights, and they push a button, and the whole logo, and the colors, everything changes. The one thing they have to do is pull the mic covers off and put the new mic covers on for the other brand. The branding change, that's what we're looking for. And then, in France, in fact, our dealer, Jerome Guerri, is here. This guy does amazing things with touch screens and all kinds of automation. You get all the information you possibly want on either a little touch screen or a great big touch screen. Mm-hmm.
Well, there is a radio group in France, and they have now all the studios just on glass. It's the RCF radio group, and that's what they're using now, yeah.
That's interesting because one of my very first, that you mentioned France, because one of my first international jobs ever before I came to work with Telos was in France at Vibration in Orléans, France. Yeah.
Okay.
We put in
big
some
Omdia users.
Yeah, we put in some Frankfurt processors there. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Wow. I think they're very innovative, and their station groups in Italy. There's one in Milan that has just, at the very least, they're very elegant studios, and you just walk in, and it's just like, there's some style in this studio.
Well, we know that as a culture, Italians tend to exude style, yeah? And, well, that tell us a little bit. Folks who go to the shows have seen a new audio console from Axia called the Quasar. And the guy who is responsible for designing its look and its features is an Italian guy.
Right. Luca La Rosa.
Luca La Rosa. I met Luca, like 15 years ago. And at the time, we made fast friends. And he said, Kurt, your console, you need an Italian to design a new console.
That's a very odd accent. And I what is that? Oh, my gosh. That is not Luca La Rosa's accent.
Oh, no. See, that's what he sounds like to me. I was in no position to hire him, but I did, bring his request back to Frank and some other people here. And eventually, we hired Luca.
Yeah.
This guy's a great designer.
Great designer.
Yeah. What
great
are you
engineer.
Hearing about the... You've been installing a bunch of Quasars.
I've not installed Quasar. I sold Quasar.
Well, no. Okay.
That console is taking off. It's great console. Fulfilling the needs of a modern, and it's filling a gap, between a classic on-air console, and it goes into the direction of production console. So you can do a lot of production stuff in the same studio as you do your on-air show. That's a big benefit of for the broadcasters, and it's all audio IP based.
So most of the viewers of this show are here in the United States of America. We're very accustomed to whatever we have here, to the style that we have here. Some of the big companies like Entercom and iHeart, and smaller mom and pop people like Midwest Communications and so forth. I got 14 stations, Delta Radio, we're kind of used to how radio is here. Where I asked you earlier about where do people uptake technology the most quickly, but where would you say that people are the most passionate about radio broadcasting, that they just love it? They still do research, and they have local programming, and people are just so excited.
I would say France.
Really?
Absolutely.
Really? The most passion for radio you find there. And if you look what the income is on commercials, radio commercials, do not get in other countries for TV commercials. I mean, that high level radio has in that market. It's incredible.
What I remember when I've heard French radio, a lot of energy on the air. Lots of energy, people, excitement and great music selection. Just a lot of energy that goes into producing. It's not sleepy radio.
No, not at all.
No, and you know what? Even the so I was looking at the taxis and all of the touch screens in the audio interface in the car. It just makes it easy to find FM radio.
Oh,
it's right there, or they're streaming. But it's always everyone has their little icon
in the French taxis.
Yeah, which I assume is in most cars.
Wow,
and you ask the taxi drivers, what are you listening to? And they're inevitably listening to radio, and they've got their favorite stations, which is cool. And they feel really passionately about these stations.
Wow. We've got to take a quick break. You're watching or listening to This Week in Radio Tech. It's episode 479. We've been doing this for over 10 years now. I'm Kirk Harnack at the Telos Alliance. Peter Passian, he's the sales director for the entire Eastern Hemisphere,
right?
Based in Germany, in Regensburg, in Bavaria, Germany. And Marianne Seidler is here, and you're responsible for...
I work with the solutions sales.
Solutions, that's right. What's kind of what I do?
What? Yeah. You tell
we should compare notes sometime.
You tell me a problem and we'll find a solution for it.
This week in radio tech. Oh, Peter, there's a little device over here we got to hold up. This thing right here. This is the famous Max Connect. And look at that. We got four full bars. If you are a broadcaster, you're a broadcast engineer, you need to go out and do a live remote broadcast somewhere, even with video, or you need an emergency link to your transmitter site, this can do it for you. This is not just an ordinary 4G hotspot, you know, data spot. No, the Max Connect is a service that gives you high priority access points with different carriers, AT&T, Verizon, now T-Mobile is in on the plan too. So you talk to Max Connect, I know it's spelled weird, maxconnectwireless.com. We'll have a link in the show notes. And you get this thing, what you get is prioritized data. So you can be in a stadium full of people at halftime, all checking their cell phones. They're all getting crummy service because now there's 4,000 people trying to use the same access point from AT&T or Verizon. Guess what? You have priority. You have a priority channel over everybody, well, except first responders. We want them to have priority. But this thing is amazing. Chris Tobin and I have used this to do this show live. We'll be using this in Las Vegas. And again, you get to pick your carrier. In fact, you can put, this one has two SIM cards in it for AT&T or Verizon. And I can just browse into here and switch which one gives me the best speed, the best service. It's also, of course, a Wi-Fi hotspot if you want to use that. But I use the wired connection usually. MaxConnectWireless.com. Josh Bone, an engineer from Alabama, put this thing together, and it is an amazing service and such a boon to broadcasters and broadcast engineers. Do remotes from where you'd never thought possible before, not necessarily because they're out in the hinterland, but because there's a million other people using the tower, and you get priority. Hey, we'll be right back. Our show is brought to you in part by the folks at CalRec. We'll be right back.
CalRec Type R is a modular, expandable IP-based radio system featuring three slimline panels, a fader panel, a large soft panel, and a small soft panel easily configured to give the operator full control. Layouts are saved and recalled quickly between shows. A single 2RU core with integrated I/O gets customers up and running fast, and that single core can power up to three independent mixing environments with no sharing of DSP resources. Available in four DSP packs, and as your station grows, larger packs can be added, enabling it to grow with you. Power to the surface is supplied via standard PoE switches, keeping cabling to a minimum. Type R is fully AES-67 compatible, as defined by SMPTE 2110, which means that it is also compliant with NMOS discovery and connection management specs. All these features combined make Type R the most flexible radio console you can buy. Find out more at calrec.com/twert.
And this week in Radio Tech brought to you by calrec.com/twert. Go to that website and they'll know that we sent you. Hey, welcome back. Kirk Harnack along with Peter Passian and Marianne Seidler. We're at the Telus Alliance in Cleveland, Ohio. Is the weather still bad outside? Has anybody looked?
Oh, yeah.
It's yucky?
Yeah.
Is it snowing more or not?
I don't know yet, but it's getting worse.
Well, hey, we've been telling stories about technology and how they do broadcasting in Germany and some of the success stories in other places. Hey, fellow engineers, if you ever get a chance to go to other countries and check out their broadcasting, I would highly encourage you to do so. You can learn so much that you bring back. Either you learn how not to do it, which you may already know, or you get some ideas on things that you can bring back. And you know what? Broadcast engineers around the world, I think, are pretty friendly. If you're an engineer, you're going to take a vacation in Australia, Italy, Poland, France, England, wherever. Try to get in touch with a broadcast engineer there. Hey, I'll help you. I got access to a bunch of people, and I know you guys do too. And we'd love to have you meet engineers from all over the world. Of course, you come to NAB, you're going to meet them there too. But it's great to go to their radio stations and see what people are doing and the passion that they have for their stuff. We got to go. I'm sorry to cut us off, but Marianne, thank you so much for being here. I'd love to hear your stories. Peter?
Kirk, thank you very much.
Thank you for being here, too. Next week, hopefully, Chris Tobin is going to be here. And let's see. Next week, I think we got my friend Ed Noyes is Yeah, Ed Noyes from South Carolina is on. Ed has done some amazing studio builds himself and has some great stories to tell as well. Thanks a lot to Suncast, our producer for the show, and thanks also to Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network. Check out all our sponsors. And remember, get your free cable from angryaudio.com. Get one for every adapter you buy, but you gotta say you heard it here on Twerk. I'm Kirk Harnack. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.